I feel like we have this this collective hallucination almost when we look at massive world-changing success.
Oh, absolutely.
Like we look at a global empire or a generational company, and we just assume the person who built it was, I don't know, struck by a radioactive meteor or something.
Right, like they have
Exactly. We want a
superpowers.
superhero origin story that is completely divorced from our own reality.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if their success is magic-like, if it's just some glowing, undeniable destiny, then it kind of lets the rest of us off the hook.
It is deeply comforting. I mean, it really is. If greatness requires a winning ticket in the genetic lottery, you don't have to feel bad about not doing the hard work today.
Yeah, you could just sit back.
You can just say, well, I wasn't born with that brain. But when you actually strip away the mythology and look at the structural architecture of how these empires are built, the magic completely
It's
vanishes.
just gone.
Gone. You are no longer looking at a comic book. You're looking at a blueprint. And you know, that blueprint is filled with incredibly mundane, repetitive, and often excruciatingly boring actions.
Totally. It's that invisible compounding effort. And that's really the mission for today's deep dive. We are unhacking the mindset of a builder.
Specifically looking at the formative years of Mark Zuckerberg, right?
Right. But not as a biography. We're doing a forensic deconstruction of how a winner's mindset is actually manufactured. We're going to dismantle that toxic myth of magic talent and extract the actual map of how massive things are built.
Which is so important for people to hear.
Because understanding this gives you, the listener, a massive advantage. When you start building your own systems and your road inevitably gets rocky, you won't panic because you'll recognize the terrain.
Yeah, and to understand that terrain, you can't start at Harvard,
Yep.
and you certainly can't start in Silicon Valley. You have to trace the root system back to the exact physical environment where that mindset was poured into the foundation.
Okay, let's unpack this.
So, for Mark, who was born in 1984, that starting line is a very specific house in Dobbs Ferry, New York. And the architecture of that home is critical. It was not your standard suburban setup.
Right, because the house was physically attached to his father's dental office.
Exactly.
His father, Edward, was a dentist, but maybe more importantly for this story, he was a massive early adopter of technology. I mean, in the late 80s and early 90s, when most dental practices were literally drowning in paper files.
Oh, just walls of manila
Yeah,
folders.
walls of them. But his dad was networking early computer systems to run the clinic.
And on the other side of that equation, his mother, Karen, was a psychiatrist.
Right.
So you have this child growing up literally enveloped by two distinct, highly complex systems. On one side of a physical wall, you have the human mind,
The study of behavior and motivation.
right, the psychology represented by his mother. And on the other side of the wall, you have the machine. The cold, logical, efficiency-driven world of early digital networking represented by his father.
It's like the synthesis of the mind and the machine.
Yes. Yes. Which, if you think about it, is the exact DNA of modern social networking. It's this massive, cold, technological infrastructure designed entirely to manipulate and map warm human psychology.
Precisely.
But, you know, the most vital component of that environment was how those machines were treated. In 1992, if a household had a computer, it was generally treated as a toy.
Like a really expensive Nintendo.
Exactly. It was a standalone box for playing solitary games. But in the Dobbs Ferry house, the computer was a lever. It was a practical, utilitarian tool used to solve tangible friction points. Like, if the front desk needed to know a patient arrived, they didn't want to yell down the hall.
Right, they needed a system.
They needed a system. So software wasn't some theoretical puzzle to show off how smart you were. It was just a hammer.
You use a hammer to drive a nail, and you use code to make an office run smoother. And he's absorbing this in a household that inherently expected achievement. Like when you grow up in an ambient temperature where the default expectation is that problems are meant to be solved, you just absorb a builder's mindset before you even know what the word means.
Which brings us to the core thesis here. The absolute biggest differentiator between people who build incredible things and people who don't is not capital. It's not IQ. It is mindset. And we really need to strip all the self-help fluff away from that word. Mindset is nothing more than your underlying operating system of beliefs. It is the specific set of rules your brain defaults to when it encounters resistance.
I think we need to ground that because, mindset is such a buzzword. Let's look at the actual mechanics of it. If you face a brutal, complicated problem at work today, your brain is going to fire off one of two default beliefs, right?
Right.
Option A is, this is incredibly difficult, which means it's probably not for me.
Yeah, a very common response.
Or option B, this is incredibly difficult, which means if I figure it out, my capacity just expanded.
And those two separate beliefs dictate two completely different biological and behavioral responses. Option A instantly kills your dopamine.
It just wipes it out.
It assassinates your discipline and gives you neurological permission to quit. Option B treats the friction as fuel. But here's the secret. Nobody is born with option B.
Wait, really? Nobody?
Nobody. That resilient belief system has to be actively manufactured through what we can call the system of small wins.
Okay, like the 10 push-ups framework. I love this concept because it sounds so insultingly simple, but the psychology behind it is bulletproof.
Oh, completely.
If you set a goal to do just 10 push-ups every single morning, like a goal so small it is physically impossible to fail, and you do it consistently for 60 days, the physical muscle you build is kind of completely irrelevant.
The physical result is just a byproduct. The actual product is the rewiring of your self-trust. By executing that tiny system daily, you forge a new undeniable belief in your brain.
Right, you prove it to yourself.
You say, when I design a system and decide to execute it, I am the type of person who follows through. You have empirical proof that you can alter your reality. And once that belief is locked in, you just point it at bigger targets.
You point it at learning a language or writing an application or, you know, structuring a company. But I have to push back on this, though.
Okay, go for it.
Because if I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, okay, that's a great psychological trick for going to the gym. But I cannot push up my way into building a multi-billion dollar tech monopoly.
Sure.
Like, there has to be a baseline of freakish innate genius here, right? If talent is a total myth, why aren't there a million Mark Zuckerbergs?
It's a completely rational pushback, but it falls into the exact trap that keeps most people paralyzed. We have this pervasive cultural belief that you must possess a magical biological advantage to achieve greatness.
Right.
But that belief is actively destructive because it hands you a comfortable scapegoat. If you fail, it's not because you lacked discipline, right? That's because you didn't have the gift.
It literally gives you a doctor's note to get out of doing the hard work.
Exactly. And the reason we fall for it is because of survivorship bias. We only ever observe the absolute final outburst. Think about an Olympic champion.
Okay.
Let's call him Johnny. You turn on your television once every 4 years, and you see Johnny standing on a podium, a gold medal around his neck, looking like a literal Greek god.
Right, and he makes it look effortless.
Exactly. Your brain, seeking the path of least resistance, immediately concludes, wow, he was born for that.
Because the alternative, like, acknowledging the sheer volume of suffering he endured to get there, that makes us feel incredibly lazy.
Exactly. But if you actually audit Johnny's daily life, you find out that for the first 16 months of his athletic career, he was completely average.
Or even below average.
Yeah, he was getting lapped in the pool. He was failing. But what nobody broadcasted on television were the 4 a.m. wake-up calls, the hyper-strict nutritional protocols, the thousands of hours of grueling, repetitive drills in empty gyms.
Yeah.
If you want an accurate definition of the word talent, it is simply this. Talent is hard work that no one saw.
Talent is hard work that no one saw. That completely reframes the narrative. So if we apply that lens to Mark, we can't look at the billionaire in the hoodie.
No.
We have to look for the unseen, unglamorous reps. We have to look at the first tools he picked up to start building that compounding internal belief.
And that starts with his father sitting him down at a home computer and teaching him his very first programming language, which was Atari BASIC.
Okay, BASIC.
Now, to understand the how here, we have to look at the mechanics of BASIC. It wasn't a dense, highly abstracted language where you had to compile thousands of lines of code just to see if it worked.
Right, you didn't have to wait an hour for it to load.
Exactly, it was an interpreted language. You typed a command, you hit return, and the computer immediately executed it.
It's an instant feedback loop. For a kid, that is neurological gold. You type print hello, and the screen says hello. You just commanded a machine to do your bidding.
Exactly. It fostered a builder's high. But the critical pattern here is that Mark didn't sit down and read the theoretical manual on computer science.
He wasn't studying the history of computing.
Right. He didn't study the abstract philosophy. He used the language to immediately start modifying his environment. He learned entirely by making things, not by studying them.
Which perfectly sets the stage for the first real manifestation of this mindset. He's, what, about 12 years old?
Yeah, around 12.
He's getting fluent in BASIC, and he observes that core friction point in his dad's dental practice. The receptionist is literally shouting through the drywall to tell his dad that a patient is in the chair.
Such a common problem back then.
Right. So a 12-year-old looks at this and thinks, I can build a digital nervous system for this building.
And he builds Zucknet.
And we really have to pause and appreciate the technical mechanics of what a 12-year-old was doing in 1996.
It's wild.
This wasn't logging into AOL Instant Messenger. He had to figure out how to network disparate desktop computers across a physical space.
He was assigning IP addresses, creating local nodes.
Yeah, and writing a protocol that allowed one machine to ping another machine with a text string without crashing the whole dental database.
He essentially coded a private local area network chat client years before the general public understood what instant messaging even was.
It's unbelievable.
And the psychological impact of building Zucknet is massive. He didn't just solve a minor annoyance. He proved to himself empirically that his mind could create a system that altered the physical behavior of the adults around him.
Wow, yeah. The front desk stopped shouting because of code he wrote.
That is the ultimate 10 push-up win. The belief is now concrete code gives me leverage over reality. And his parents didn't just give him a pat on the back for this.
No, they recognized what was happening.
They realized he had outgrown the structural limits of Atari Basic and his dad's knowledge. So they hire a software developer, David Newman, to come to the house once a week to tutor him.
And very quickly, he outgrows the tutor too.
Hmm.
By his early teens, he is commuting to Mercy College to take graduate-level computer science courses.
Yeah, as a kid.
I want to isolate this because it's easy to misinterpret. A young teenager sitting in a graduate class with adults usually screams tiger parenting.
Oh, totally. It sounds like a resume builder.
Right. It sounds like parents forcing a kid to build a transcript for Harvard.
But it was the exact opposite. He was in that room driven by an insatiable, organic hunger to understand more complex systems. When you realize that code is power, and you've already tasted that power by building Zucknet, your only logical desire is to acquire a deeper vocabulary.
Because he wanted to build bigger things.
Exactly. He wanted to learn C++ or deeper architectural logic because he wanted to build, not because he wanted a certificate.
So if he's outgrowing graduate-level curriculum as a teenager, where does all that excess intellectual energy go? Well, it goes into mapping human taste. Which brings us to the late 90s, early 2000s, and a piece of software he built with his friend Adam called Synapse.
Synapse is a fascinating leap in complexity. Mark and Adam, who, by the way, later becomes the CTO of Facebook, they were looking at the music landscape.
This is the era of Winamp, right?
Yeah, the Winamp era. If you wanted to listen to MP3s, you manually dragged files into a playlist. It was a static, dumb system.
Right. The computer didn't know anything about the music. It just played the file you clicked.
But Mark and Adam built an algorithmic layer on top of that. Synapse was a smart music player that monitored your behavior. It didn't just play music, it watched how you listened.
Noah.
It tracked if you skipped a song after 10 seconds. It tracked if you played a specific artist heavily on Friday nights.
So it was learning.
Yes. It used collaborative filtering to build a mathematical vector of your mood and taste, and then automatically generated predictive playlists.
So they were building a primitive Spotify recommendation engine while they were still in high school.
Pretty much.
And it was so mechanically sound that the heavyweights of the tech industry immediately smelled blood in the water.
Yeah.
Like AOL and Microsoft didn't just want to license it, they wanted to buy it outright.
The accounts state that the offers on the table were in the realm of $1 to $2 million.
A million.
Yes, $1 to $2 million. Plus, they wanted to hire Mark and Adam to come work for them.
Okay, I have to stop here.
Yeah.
Because this is where the psychology of the builder diverges completely from the psychology of a normal person.
It really does.
If you, the listener, put yourself in those shoes right now. You are a high school student. Someone offers you $2 million for a music player you built for fun. Who says no to that?
Almost nobody.
I am taking that money. That is life-altering generational security. It is a VIP pass to the top of the tech food chain before you even take your SATs. How do you possibly justify saying no to that?
Because taking the money violates the core principle he had been building since Zucknet. It violates the control principle.
Control principle.
Yes. If you sell to Microsoft, you get cash, but you lose the asset, you lose the intellectual property, and most importantly, you lose your autonomy. You become an employee executing someone else's vision.
Wow.
Mark recognized, even as a teenager, that his freedom to tinker, to maintain absolute control over his creations, was infinitely more valuable than a corporate payout.
It's the muscle of saying no. And building that muscle early is vital because, you know, it's easy to say no to bad ideas, But it takes extreme psychological fortitude to say no to $2 million.
Absolutely.
And he didn't just do it once. This established a permanent behavioral groove in his brain.
Exactly. Years later, in 2006, when Facebook was blowing up but was still a volatile startup, Yahoo came to him with a formal offer to buy the company for $1 billion in cold hard cash.
$1 billion. With a B.
With a B. His investors wanted to sell. His executives wanted to sell. And he walked into the boardroom and essentially said, this is just a formality. We're obviously not selling.
Because he had already practiced that exact same rejection with Microsoft when he was 17. The stakes just gained a few zeros.
Right. The muscle was already there.
He prized the builder's control over the safety of the exit.
Yeah.
So instead of moving to Redmond to work for Bill Gates, he chooses to maintain his independence and enrolls at Harvard in 2002.
And this raises an important question, right? If you turn down millions to go to college, what exactly do you do when you get there? And the answer is, he does not treat Harvard as an academic institution. He treats the entire university as a closed ecosystem laboratory to test human psychology at scale.
His reputation as a prodigy was already established. But what he builds at Harvard shifts away from pure utility, like a dental intercom or a music player, and moves directly into social mapping.
Yeah, the focus changes completely.
One of the first experiments is Course Match.
Course Match seems incredibly simple on the surface. Harvard students had a tough time figuring out which classes to take, so Mark built a tool where students could log in and see exactly which courses their peers were registering for.
But the mechanics of why it worked is the secret sauce. Course Match proved that he profoundly understood the deepest lever of human behavior.
Which is?
We make decisions by watching the tribe. If you give a human a list of 500 academic courses, they are paralyzed by choice. But if you show them that 40 of their friends are taking Intro to Economics, they will immediately enroll in Intro to Economics.
It's true. We are inherently, almost obsessively curious about the social graph around us. Course Match was the first time Mark successfully converted that abstract human curiosity into a digital interface.
Right.
He realized that the most valuable data on the internet wasn't information, it was the relationships between people.
But testing the limits of human psychology in a closed laboratory can get incredibly volatile, which leads us to 2003 and the creation of FaceMash.
FaceMash is the ultimate display of the builder's instinct stripped of all guardrails. The mechanical premise was brute force virality.
It was messy.
Very messy. Mark scraped the digital Facebooks, like the directories of student photos from various Harvard houses. He put two photos side by side and asked the user to vote on who was more attractive.
It's important to understand the algorithm he used here, because it wasn't just a simple tally. He implemented the ELO rating system.
Right, which is the exact same mathematical formula used to rank grandmasters in chess.
It's exactly like in chess. If a highly rated photo loses to a low rated photo, the low rated photo gains a massive amount of points and the high rated one plummets. It created a dynamic, constantly shifting leaderboard.
And the psychological trigger it exploited was primal status anxiety. Everyone wanted to see where they ranked, and everyone wanted to judge their peers.
The mechanics of virality were so perfectly engineered that when he launched it, it swept through the Harvard network with astonishing speed. The server traffic spiked so hard it actually crashed parts of Harvard's internet infrastructure.
It literally broke the system, and it also crashed right into the university disciplinary board.
Oh yeah, he was in huge trouble.
Because to build the database, he had bypassed university security to scrape those photos. He was hauled in on charges of breaching security, violating copyrights, and violating individual privacy.
It was a massive pivot point. FaceMash was undeniably controversial and reckless, but strictly from a systems engineering perspective, it was a blazing neon sign.
How so?
It proved, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that Mark possessed the rare ability to architect a system that could trigger explosive, exponential human engagement overnight. He knew how to build the reactor. He just needed a safer core to put inside it.
That's a great way to put it.
And that explosive notoriety is exactly what caught the attention of the Harvard Connection founders.
This is a crucial chapter to dissect because it completely reorients how we value innovation. A group of upperclassmen approached Mark with an idea for an exclusive dating and networking site just for Harvard students.
Now, we know there was a massive legal fallout here with the Winklevoss twins and all that. But given the drama with Harvard Connection, doesn't it prove that having the idea is the most important part?
Actually, it proves the exact opposite.
Really?
Yeah, that logic is fundamentally flawed because it completely misunderstands the economy of innovation. In 2003, the idea of a social network for college students was practically atmospheric.
Like everyone was thinking about it.
Everyone. Friendster existed. MySpace was launching. Hundreds of developers on campuses across the country were sketching out similar concepts. Ideas are cheap, abundant, and entirely frictionless.
You can have a billion-dollar idea while you're taking a shower. It costs you zero calories.
Exactly. What is excruciatingly rare and therefore insanely valuable is the execution. The Harvard Connection guys had an idea. What they lacked was the ability to sit in a chair for 14 hours a day, architect the database, write clean PHP, design an intuitive user interface, and build a scalable infrastructure that wouldn't crash when 1,000 people logged on at once.
Right. Code is expensive. Execution is expensive.
And Mark was the execution engine, which brings us to the culmination of his entire life's work up to that point, February 4, 2004.
The launch of the Facebook.com from his dorm room.
The defining metric of this launch, and the fact that still stuns software engineers today, is that Mark built the original version of the Facebook in approximately one single week.
Wait, 7 days.
7 days from blank screen to functional viral platform.
But if we've been paying attention to the map we've been drawing, we know that the one-week miracle is an illusion.
What's fascinating here is how it all connects.
Yeah, he didn't invent Facebook in a week. He assembled it in a week. Here's where it gets really interesting. It's like a Lego set.
I love that analogy.
He didn't invent new bricks in that 1 week in February. He just took the messaging brick from Zucknet, the algorithm brick from Synapse, the peer curiosity brick from Course Match, and snapped them all together.
Precisely. This is the synthesis of everything we've discussed. It was modular programming on a life scale. When he sat down to build the Facebook, he didn't have to figure out how to write a messaging protocol from scratch.
Because he already did it when he was 12.
Right. He just reached back into his mental library and pulled the mechanics he developed for Zucknet.
He didn't have to guess how to map peer influence because he already perfected it with Course Match.
And he didn't have to invent a way to handle exponential server load because he had already stress tested that exact problem when FaceMash went viral.
It's the ultimate proof that talent is just unseen hard work. That 1 week in February was just the final assembly of Lego bricks he had spent the last 8 years painstakingly molding in the dark.
And because the architecture was built on such solid psychological principles, the growth was violent. By June of 2004, just 4 months after launching, the site had nearly 160,000 active users.
That is insane scale.
It was jumping from Harvard to Yale to Stanford to Columbia. It was described as dry grass catching the same fire.
Let's break down the mechanics of that fire, because other networks existed, like you said, but they didn't catch fire like this. Why was the combustion so perfect?
Three distinct architectural decisions. First, he enforced the real name policy.
Which was huge.
Prior to this, the internet was largely anonymous. You had a handle like Skate or Boy99. By forcing people to use their real identities, he engineered trust. It felt accountable.
Second, the walled garden. You couldn't just sign up. You needed a .edu email address from a specific supported university.
Which engineered safety and exclusivity. When you logged in, you knew you're in a closed ecosystem with your actual physical peers. And third, it leaned entirely into the Course Match insight.
Meaning the social aspect.
Right. It gave you a socially acceptable way to spy on the people around you. And it gave you a stage to be seen by them in return. It perfectly digitized the college experience.
Okay. So the reactor is fully online and it's generating massive power.
Mm-hmm.
But this introduces the final and perhaps most dangerous obstacle in the builder's journey.
Scaling it.
Exactly. So what does this all mean for the future of the site? Once you've built the ultimate machine for your campus, how do you keep control of it on a global scale? How do you not lose it to the suits on Wall Street who just want to extract the value and toss you aside?
You have to evolve from an engineer into an executive. And to do that, you have to change your environment. In the summer of 2004, Mark moves the operation out of the dorms and goes west, setting up headquarters in Palo Alto, California.
Ground zero of the tech industry.
This move is a massive psychological threshold. It signals that this is no longer a college project. It is an apex predator company. But the most critical element of this transition was Mark's self-awareness.
What do you mean?
He knew exactly what he was, a brilliant systems architect. He also knew exactly what he wasn't. He wasn't a seasoned, shark-like corporate operator.
Which is why the introduction of Sean Parker at this exact moment is so vital.
Sean Parker was already tech royalty. He co-founded Napster, the peer-to-peer network that essentially forced the entire global music industry to its knees.
Right. He was infamous.
Parker had been to war, he understood venture capital, he understood exponential growth, and he understood how hostile corporate takeovers worked.
Parker essentially looks at this 20-year-old kid with a rocket ship, and he says, "I am going to build a fortress around your captain's chair."
And he did it through brilliant corporate structuring. Parker didn't just introduce Mark to Silicon Valley investors. He architected the legal foundation of the company to ensure Mark would never be fired from his own creation.
Let's explain the mechanics of that because it's brilliant. Usually, when a startup takes millions of dollars from venture capitalists, those investors get seats on the board of directors.
Standard practice, yeah.
Right. And if the investors eventually own a majority of the shares, they can literally vote to fire the founder. It happens all the time. Think of Steve Jobs getting pushed out of Apple in the 80s.
But Parker set up a dual-class stock structure for Facebook. He created a system where Mark's shares held super voting power. So even if outside investors eventually owned 70% of the actual financial equity of the company, Mark would still retain over 50% of the voting power.
It is the ultimate manifestation of the Synapse decision. When he turned down Microsoft at 17, it was to keep control. Parker helped him structuralize that desire for control so he wouldn't lose his creation to corporate interests.
Exactly. He took that teenage instinct and hard-coded it into the legal bylaws of a multi-billion-dollar corporation. He ensured that no matter how big the machine got, Mark's hands would be the only ones permanently glued to the steering wheel.
And with that structural fortress in place, Parker brings in Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, who writes the first major institutional check.
$500,000.
Right. And Thiel provides the raw capital needed to buy the servers and hire the engineers to take the network global. They gave the engine the fuel it needed to leave the atmosphere.
And what happened later is, well, history.
History, yeah. And as this story concludes, that blueprint, the mind in the machine, the small wins, the muscle of saying no, the modular execution, it literally built the modern world.
It is the definitive proof that greatness is not an accident of birth. It is the result of compounding deliberate design.
So let's synthesize this map for everyone listening. We started in a dental office in Dobbs Ferry, watching a kid learn the instant feedback loop of Atari Basic. We watched him code an intercom just to solve a real-world friction point, proving code is power.
We saw him cultivate the sheer nerve to reject life-altering money to protect his autonomy.
And we saw how years of those invisible, unglamorous reps allowed him to assemble a world-conquering platform in just 7 days. The overnight success is statistically impossible.
What looks like magic is always just the sudden visibility of years of quiet labor.
Which leaves us with a final provocative thought for you to carry into your day. We've spent this entire hour dissecting how talent is just hard work that no one saw. We've mapped how disconnected projects, like a chat protocol, a music algorithm, a course selector, suddenly fused into a singular masterpiece.
So I want you to audit your own life right now. Look at the seemingly random skills you are struggling to acquire. Look at the side projects you tinker with on the weekends. Look at the boring daily routines you are trying to maintain when nobody's clapping for you.
Ask yourself, what are the unfilmed reps you are executing today?
Because while they might feel completely fragmented or utterly insignificant right now, they are actually the raw, structural Lego bricks you are going to desperately need when it is time to assemble your own one-week miracle down the road.
Stop waiting for a radioactive meteor to strike you and just go build your system. Do your 10 push-ups. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive into the architecture of a builder's mind. Keep learning, keep building systems, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.